I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Today, we continue our participation with the NPR project, A Nation Engaged, that aims to spark conversations that matter. With President Donald J. Trump approaching the 100-day milestone of his administration, we explore the topic of power and the presidency with citizens who both support and oppose him. We'll also hear from historians for perspective on the power of the executive office. Since the days of George Washington, who among our presidents have pushed the powers of the office the furthest? We'll wrap up with Brian McTavish and the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. NPR project, A Nation Engaged, asked four member stations with presidential libraries in their areas to partner with them for a look at power and the presidency. KCUR was one of those stations, and that's how NPR's John Burnett and I found ourselves moderating an audience discussion in the auditorium of the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library the other night. Here's John.
Let's go to our first question, first block of questions, actually. What we want to explore is, how is President Trump within the tradition of the American presidency? To frame it a little better, how is he outside the tradition of the American presidency? And how is he acting like past presidents or not acting like past presidents? I'd like to invite Gail Brecke to the microphone to give us her view. It's also the time for those of you who want to help answer these questions, be thinking of them. And also remember, hashtag A Nation Engaged. So let me ask the Truman archivist, Randy Soule. In these parts, it's fair to say that Give 'Em Hell Harry was a very popular figure. How did the public judge him when he first came into office? Did they find him presidential in 1945? He'd been vice president for fewer than 90 days. He had to become a commander-in-chief and end a world war.
I don't think he was seen as presidential by most Americans. He was seen as kind of the little man. Most Americans didn't know much about him. Roosevelt had been president for 12 years. It was hard for a lot of Americans to envision anyone else as president. And Truman was very different from Roosevelt. He came from the Midwest. He came from a humble background. He had not gone to Harvard. He had not gone to any college or university. He was had been a farmer and a small businessman. And so, yeah, he seemed to be not what people had thought of as a president. But I think some of the virtues of that background, the honesty, the simplicity, the humility of the man, in the long run, helped him and helped him win over the American public. But the first reaction was, I think the shock of Roosevelt's death was so great, Truman was kind of an afterthought, and some people genuinely afraid that this fellow was going to be president.
Right. So unlike Truman, we have our current president who's had no military experience, no public office experience, brand new in the presidency. Gail, thanks for being here and thanks for waiting.
Sure.
How do you view President Trump within the tradition of the American presidency?
I would agree with what you just said in terms of he is not the traditional president in terms of having been a politician, a career politician perhaps. He, I think, most obviously is a businessman. He is not first and foremost a politician. So I think to many of us, he appears to be very different. He behaves differently than presidents that we've seen in the past because of that. So I think he seems to be interested in behaving as a businessman would in terms of getting things done and fixing things, and not so much necessarily interested in the politics of the House and Senate and legislation and what the typical process has been. So I think he does appear to me to be different than past presidents in that way.
Do you think that's a strength or a liability?
Perhaps a little of both. I think you know, his way of getting things done and just, you know, sticking with his agenda and just being very proactive and trying to get things fixed and get movement on things could be a good thing, particularly if you like what he's doing. I think it can be a little bit challenging at times to feel like you're kind of with him and understand what he's doing and why. So I think it's a mixed bag.
Okay, jury's out. Max, do you want to talk about other presidents who were considered outside the tradition of the office in their times?
The only ones I can think of who in any way were sufficiently outside that he could be considered, that they could be considered at all, like Mr. Trump, would be, first of all, Andrew Jackson. He was the first person to assume the presidency who had not been part of the governing elite, the governing group, the national gentry, as someone had
once. He was completely outside the box.
Completely,
right?
Outside the box. He was nominated by the state legislature of Tennessee, not by the congressional caucus that had always nominated everyone else. He was the first president to be catapulted to the office by popular acclaim. Andrew Jackson was a popular hero dating all the way back to 1815 and the Battle of New Orleans that wound up the, he thought, wound up the War of 1812 that, unknown to him, was already over, and unknown to the British was already over, but the television reception was very poor in those days.
Well, is he the president who was as far outside the box, Max, as any president until President Trump?
Probably. I would say as a runner-up would be Abraham Lincoln. At least in the South, he was viewed as someone who was completely off base, completely out of the mainstream and so forth. Turns out that he, by almost all measures, has turned out to be the best of all people who have occupied the presidency.
Okay. We have a really great question on Twitter here, Randy, what do you think about this? Are Trump's tweets like FDR's fireside chats, should they be archived as part of the National Archives?
I believe they probably will be.
You think they will be? Yeah. You think they should be?
Yes. I think Mr. Truman believed very strongly, and I tend to agree with him, that everything a president writes and says, anything that he records that relates to his term of office or his responsibilities as president should be preserved. And so I would have to say yes.
Okay. Ma'am, if you would, tell us your name and what you do.
My name is Toni Vienz, and I am a real estate consultant. And Steve, you and I have something in common. We both like Prairie Home Companion.
There you go.
And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to give you some insight. I'm a good Italian girl, first generation Italian, brought up in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. So after graduate school, I went back to New York City. I went to the University of Florida for my graduate and undergraduate studies. And back then, when I graduated, women were made a lot more money in New York City than they made in Tampa, Florida. I ended up being Vice President Chief Appraiser of National Westminster Bank. I attended a number of Mr. Trump's meetings. And I also met and had lunch with Larry Silverstein and his wife when regarding the World Trade Centers. So those of you who are more schooled on Prairie Home Companion, Trump is really very much a New Yorker. And a lot of his bombastic attitude and way of doing things is not that he's trying to be crude or rude or offend people. That's the way many New Yorkers are. And that's it. And I could tell you some jokes, but I'm going to sit down.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
My name is Dave Boehner. I'm retired. Spent most of my life in the banking world. But I guess the Trump is certainly non-traditional. And I think that's a good thing. If you look up what's happened in Washington in the last 50, 60 years, where we've constantly passed new laws, where we've constantly run up deficits, especially the last 8 years, something has to change. We as taxpayers and citizens out here in flyover country, we need to have a voice and we need to hold Washington responsible. And I hope Trump accomplishes a third of the things he set out to do. He has a lot of people against him doing many other things that he's brought up, but hopefully he will.
So 100 days in, how much difference do you think he's going to wind up making?
As I said, if he can accomplish a third of the goals that he set out that got him elected, I'll be a happy camper, because he's a third of the government, and you know, he has to deal with the Senate, he has to deal with the Supreme Court, and all those people have their say, as that's how the Constitution was put together. So, you know, how much can he accomplish? If he accomplishes a third, I'm a happy camper.
What's the most important thing for you that you hope he accomplishes?
How many hours can I speak? You know, we have overtaxation, we have overregulation, we have overspending, and those are the three, I think, most important things.
Okay. Yes, sir, yes, welcome.
My name is Tom Handley. I'm a retired actuary. I dealt with uncertainty for over 40 years. You know, I had to predict people's behavior, you know, were they going to go to the doctor, how many prescriptions, and so it was a very difficult task. So uncertainty is something that I live with every day.
So it doesn't bother you?
Oh, no, it bothers me, because I think particularly with the presidency, there needs to be some predictability, some confidence that he is going to do the right thing. And in the first 100 days, I'm not sure we're there yet. He's changed his opinions. He wants the wall to be built, but he's not going to get Mexico to pay for it. He was elected because he was non-traditional. I mean, that's what got him elected.
Right.
And now, you know, he has to follow through. If he gets a third of the stuff done, I'll be shocked. You know, and I would say that about any presidency, not just Donald Trump.
Tom, thank you. We're going to move on now to the second block of the evening. And the question on the table is, if Donald Trump is taking a different approach to wielding the powers of the presidency, is that because that's what his voters were asking for? I'm going to ask that Karen Spaulding come to the head of the line for just a moment. And while she does that, we're going to turn to both Max and Randy one more time here. When it comes to wielding power, one thing President Obama brought attention to in his closing days, as President Trump has in his first 100, is the executive order. Max, who was the first president to use it? And, you know, was this something specifically laid out in the Constitution of this country?
The Constitution does provide for executive orders, but you have to infer it. In Article 2, it says the executive power will be exercised by a president of the United States. It doesn't define the executive power. But executives recognize that in order to function satisfactorily as an executive, you have to have the power to issue orders and issue executive orders. Again, you have to infer it. But who was the first president? It's probably no surprise that it was George Washington.
Really?
In fact, every person who has ever held the office of president has issued executive orders, except one, William Henry Harrison, who died a month after he was inaugurated. He didn't have time to issue an executive order.
Let's give Max Skidmore a round of applause for being so full of facts this evening. That's pretty good. Randy, a question for you. I think many of us are aware of President Truman's use of the executive order to desegregate the military, but maybe not as many are aware of how he used it against the steel industry back in 1952. Give us a brief history of what happened there.
Well, we were engaged in the Korean War. President Truman had issued a proclamation declaring a national emergency. The steel unions wanted more pay. The steel companies were resisting this. They wanted to be able to raise their prices. Basically, the negotiations came to a head. A strike was imminent. President Truman did not feel that he could allow, as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, the interruption of the production of steel in a time of national emergency. It was crucial to the armed forces to keep the steel on the way, so in April of 1952, he issued an executive order essentially nationalizing the steel industry. He seized the major steel companies, put them under the control of the Secretary of Commerce. They were still administered by, the workers still worked there, the company administrators still worked there, but the Secretary of Commerce was overseeing everything.
Can you imagine that happening today?
Quite a step. Truman was immediately challenged in court by the steel companies. They sued. The case very quickly went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and only a couple of months after Truman's executive order, in I guess it was June of 1952, the U.S. Supreme Court declared in the Youngstown Tube and Steel case that President Truman did not have the constitutional authority to seize private property under those circumstances. Truman had acted on the supposition that he possessed the inherent powers as president under the Constitution, as commander-in-chief in a time of national emergency, to do this. The Supreme Court said that he did not have those inherent powers, and Truman had not acted on the basis of any statutory powers granted him by law by Congress. He said, I don't need that. I'm the president. This is a time of national emergency. I can do this. The Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, much to Mr. Truman's displeasure, said, no, you can't do that.
All right. Karen Spaulding, thanks for coming. So the question again, if President Truman is wielding powers differently, is that because that's what the voters asked for? What do you say?
I believe it is. I think that Donald Trump did not care what the media thought. He doesn't care what anybody thinks, as we well know from his tweets, which are kind of, in my opinion, sometimes not presidential and not diplomatic. But I think his voters wanted that. I think we're tired of diplomacy to the point where it's so wishy-washy that we don't have anybody making a strong voice for what we believe in. And it's been many, many years since we heard a candidate stand up strong and not be concerned about this issue or that issue to the point where we did not even know where he stood. And when Donald Trump came to getting ready for the presidency, he was strong and he said these things, and we said, wow, someone is finally voicing what we are feeling. And even if it was rude, even if he did have some checkered past, we didn't care about the past. We only cared for what was happening at that time and what he had to say. And we all know that there is a drug problem from Mexico. We know that there's trafficking from Mexico. And the media, to me, turned that whole Mexican thing into a race issue when it is far greater than that. And he knows that. And a lot of us, if we took time to think about it, we would know that too. And a lot of what he does in the presidential capacity, he is doing overwhelmingly because he knows and has researched what needs to be done. And he doesn't tell us all what it is because he doesn't want to have people come against what he is trying to work. And that's one thing about Trump, and I think that the voters thought that, is that this man is not going to care what other people think. He's going to stick with what he thinks is right, and I think that was his strength. So, yeah, I think the voters thought that he was going to be that kind of a guy.
Karen Spaulding, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
We have a comment on social media here.
Yeah.
Randy, let's throw this to you. How are Harry Truman and Donald Trump alike or different with regards to their willingness to learn on the job and seek wise counsel? Great question.
Well, I think Truman was willing to do that and was open-minded about seeking wise counsel. He did not have much of an ego, really, when he came into the presidency, because he knew that he had a lot to learn. And he was willing to appoint Jimmy Burns as Secretary of State, a man who had wanted really to be president, was very disappointed that he hadn't been chosen as vice presidential nominee in 1944. But Truman felt that he needed Burns in that position, so he appointed him. He appointed strong men to positions of, like Secretary of State after Burns, George C. Marshall, whom Truman greatly admired, Dean Acheson. He was willing to seek the advice of people who had considerable experience in government, and it was an on-the-job learning process.
So bring us up to 2017, compare and contrast.
I can't say as an outsider. Donald Trump seems to have much more self-assurance coming into the presidency than Truman did. Of course, he was not thrust into the job in the way that Truman was. He had actively campaigned for the office. I would say the impression that I have of Trump is not lack of confidence. It's kind of overweening confidence, super confidence, that he can come in and make major changes, not feeling the need to rely on others for advice. Now, obviously, as president, eventually you do have to rely on others.
It's time for a break. When we return, we'll continue our look at power and the presidency. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Welcome back. Yesterday's conversation with children's authors about LitFest KC and our look back at your first concerts are at kcur.org/up-to-date and on the NPR One app. Monday on the show, we look at the future of civil discourse and talk to a real live mermaid. You're listening to A Nation Engaged, Power and the Presidency, recorded earlier this week at the Truman Library and Museum. NPR Southwest reporter John Burnett and I were asking the questions, and audience members lined up at the microphones to give us their answers.
I'm Deborah Parmet. I've been a math tutor, and I do a lot of volunteer work. I think it's very important for us to have the correct facts, and as the other gentleman said, to make our own minds up, but I think we need to have the true facts. And my feeling is President Trump does not want us to have the true facts in many areas, and he falsely accuses the press all the time and calls it fake news. So I think it is very important that the press come out and give us the true facts. And then I think opinions from the press are important if they're labeled opinions. Editorials can be very enlightening, I think. They can be very thought-provoking, I think. But if we cannot rely on facts, then how do you make any decisions? If 1 + 1 is not 2, what do you do? I mean, all the many, many complicated issues before us, if we cannot rely on facts, well, let's write a fairy tale.
Yes, sir.
I'm Dan Hall, and
Hi, Dan.
I'm in agricultural management, my field. And I'd like to address the question on the board, which is Donald Trump taking a different approach to the presidency because of his voters? I would say absolutely yes. But I do think that voters were interested in jobs, the economy. They saw a businessman that could make a change and bring jobs to this country. The coal miners were out of work. He wanted to put them back to work, and is doing so, and has met with some of the major corporations and encouraged them to bring jobs back to America. And I think this is exactly what the 40% or more of the people in this country voted for, and I think he's doing exactly what we wanted.
So you think he's off to a good start in that regard?
In that regard, yes. But he's had lots of problems with his own Congress, his own party, and with the other party. Many of the federal appointments haven't been made because they haven't been taken up yet.
Dan, thank you. Let's move on to block number three, John.
Good. Okay. This is great. We're lubricated now. So we've asked you, what do you think about President Trump in the tradition of the presidency? What's behind his approach to the power of the office? We've been having lots of strong opinions, so let's keep going in that vein. Is the Trump presidential style good for the presidency? Is it good for American democracy? I would like to ask Reverend Vernon Howard to please come up to the microphone. Quick question for Randy Soule. Has history come down on the question of whether or not Harry Truman was a good president, as historians are looking forward to critiquing Donald Trump in a few more years?
Mm-hmm. Well, the most recent C-SPAN poll of historians and political scientists ranked Truman as the 6th greatest president in American history. I suppose that most American historians regard him as a successful president, even a great or near great president. That doesn't mean all historians agree with that verdict, but you won't find all historians agreeing on anything. So,
But when he left office, he was unpopular.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Oh, the Korean War was unpopular. The McCarthyism was rampant at that time. The Democrats had controlled the presidency for 20 years. People were ready for a change. And some of Truman's eccentricities had alarmed people, his threatening to punch out a music critic who criticized his daughter Margaret's singing performance, his unconventional shirts that he wore down in Key West, the Hawaiian shirts. He was kind of, some people didn't think that was suitable for a president to be saying and doing and behaving in such ways. Just a combination of things, I would say. Mostly distaste for the Korean War and this very unpopular war. People forget about how unpopular the Korean War was.
Right.
It was a deadlock like Vietnam, and Truman bore the brunt of that.
Reverend Howe, your thoughts on the Trump presidency coming up on 100 days.
With respect to policy, two things that the president said, did, ran on, and I heard it today as a matter of reference to the president's strength. The president said Mexico was going to pay for the wall that we built. The president said China was going to stop its currency exploitation, manipulation, and its unfair trade balances. In order to put America back to work again as a populist movement president. And yet, it appears to me, the president came back from both engagements with those leaders with nothing to say, no policy change to report, except that they were good meetings, but that now looking for other avenues, such as the American people, to pay for the wall, and nothing on China's exploitation of the U.S. worker and the U.S. economy. So the goodness that this president brings to us, both tangible and intangible, from my perspective, is questionable at least, and not present at all at the most.
But we're hearing and we're seeing a somewhat different man than the one who campaigned now. In these first 100 days, as you noted, he has walked back on some of these statements that he said that he was going to knock it out of the park. He's been learning on the job, a rather steep learning curve. Are you heartened at all that that he is learning, that he is becoming a different man than you saw in the campaign and could go on to be a good president?
I see no difference in his purported agendas. I think he's given effort. What he has found is failure, whether it is ACA, whether it is building the wall, whether it is calling China to be more sensitive and fair with us. I don't see a different man. I see a man who has discovered that, well, just like he discovered with healthcare, I never knew it could be so hard. I think he has discovered that the presidency is easy to criticize from the outside, but harder to manage from the inside.
Reverend Howard, thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. My name's Bridget McCandless. You asked my profession. I work in philanthropy. One of the things that is critical in the world of advocacy is having an engaged electorate. I would say that one of the things that Trump's style has done is to undermine people's belief in the voting system, in making a mockery of what is what I consider people's most important responsibility in being a civic citizen, which is being a thoughtful and engaged voter. By undermining that, I think that's just terrible for American democracy. And I hope that you are seeing actually perhaps the other side of that, with people becoming more engaged and giving more voice to what kind of America that they choose to live in, and by bringing the concerns of a very broad base of people to bear when we develop policy and think about the agenda.
He undermined the voting system. Help me with that.
By making false claims that millions of people were voting who were not eligible to vote,
right.
It makes people question the validity of their local elections, their state elections, and their presidential elections.
Thank you, Bridget. Yes, sir. Good evening.
My name is Mark Anthony Jones, and I co-own three businesses, and I'm chairman of the Jackson County Republican Committee. So I look at your hashtag, and as I listened to the last two people speak, I thought one letter change in that hashtag is actually what happened in this last election. it could be called a nation enraged. Because that's what really happened. Donald Trump spoke to the angry America who are tired of deficit, debt, overspending, irresponsibility. You know, I listen to a lot of disagreement on my committee. I think it's a good thing that we disagree. I think if you have disagreement among a committee, you actually can work together because you have different thoughts. No, we don't all have to agree on everything, because sometimes you learn that you don't have all the facts, and sometimes you learn more things than, I mean, you have a different perspective once you learn more facts. And so I think some of us could take a little bit of a lesson from that and learn a few more facts instead of going off half-cocked and listing out a whole bunch of things that enrage your opponent. That seems to be a better way to do this, to try to work together and find something that is common ground so that you can accomplish a few things along the way. I look for at least a third of these things to be accomplished because there's a bit of tenacity that goes along with the presidency. And I think Trump has the personality and style to have the tenacity to outlast his opponents on some of these issues. Not every single one of them. But I wish we could stop poking each other in the eye, so to speak, and try to work together.
Mark Anthony Jones, thank you very much. Ma'am?
I wanted to comment on the question, is President Trump's style good for the presidency? Is it good for American democracy? I feel that there is a myth of the American businessman as a leader. I think they are completely different things. People who run corporations particularly are legally required to act really only with the best interest of the shareholders at stake, having nothing to do with the welfare of the workers. It's a completely different responsibility. A government is not a business. We have to, everyone has to be accounted for. You can't just discard people, you know, and move on and say, you know, we're going to profit. Government is not a business. You know, it is in my best interest to make sure we're all taken care of. It's in my best interest to make sure that people get mental health care, people get, you know, medical care. You know, I mean, it's like this is things that businesses don't have a responsibility for. So and President Trump himself in the recent AP article acknowledged, oh, I just learned, you know, when you're in business, you don't have to have heart. Now I gotta consider heart. It's like, yeah, you do. It's not a business. It shouldn't be a business.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Good evening.
My name is Mark Duke, and I practice employment law. And on the question whether President Trump's style is good for the presidency or good for democracy, no, I don't think so. Not good for the presidency or for democracy or for humanity in general.
Because?
For two reasons. One having to do with confidence, and one having to do with truth-telling. I mean, there was a mention earlier of confidence, the confidence he expresses. I think it's extremely important for us to have a confident leader, but I don't think he is. I think he's blustery, but I think the confidence that he expresses is really more of a mask for rampant insecurity. The tweets about the size of the crowd at the inauguration and about the continued tweets about his Electoral College victory. He wants people to like him, and that clouds, I think, everything he does. And as far as truth-telling, I think people will say, well, all politicians hide the truth or lie. I think politicians and lawyers, being around lawyers all the time, will shade the truth in a certain way, but that's not what he does.
Okay, thank you. I hold in my hands the final question of the evening. The question on the table is, how much power should any president have? Questions to help frame this conversation. First, should extraordinary circumstances ever justify a president stepping on the generally understood powers of the office like Truman did when he took control of the steel mills, as we heard about earlier tonight? Question two, if circumstances suggest additional powers are needed by the president, how should those powers be bestowed? And thirdly, has the system worked, and should we just leave well enough alone? As you're thinking of your answers, we'll turn to Max Skidmore for a final time. Max, you say a president can approach the power of the office like Teddy Roosevelt or William Howard Taft. Would you briefly explain those two very different views of the office?
Yes, these are the two polar opposites of presidential responsibility and authority. President Theodore Roosevelt advocated what he called the stewardship theory. He said the President of the United States has not only the power but the duty to do anything that the good of the public requires, provided that the Constitution does not forbid it, nor the laws. It's not like a president who would assert, I have the right to arrest anyone I think is dangerous and hold that person without counsel, without habeas corpus, without recourse to the courts or to laws. William Howard Taft, on the other hand, said that's a dangerously activist view of the presidency. The president should do only what the Constitution specifies specifically that he do or that Congress directs him to do.
Okay, just that simple. Ma'am, come on forward.
Karen Spaulding.
Yeah, Karen.
And I just want to say one thing. He's not the dictator. You know, we have checks and balances for a reason. And Donald Trump, he has as much power as Congress and the judicial system are going to allow him to have, and the Constitution. And so that's what I am counting on, where we're concerned about what Trump's going to do and the things that he's going to do. We have checks and balances in place, and we need to use them. And that's why we're here tonight, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Karen, thanks again. Max, do you want to give us a rundown of the three or four presidents who stretched their presidential authority the most? Is there some consensus on this?
Well, most notably, Abraham Lincoln did in the wartime emergency, and he did it for certainly a good cause. Woodrow Wilson is known for having stretched it. Franklin Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, he is the one who asserted the right to arrest anyone if he thought this person presented a threat. I was amazed that there wasn't a popular outcry at that.
Right.
The people ultimately have control over government, but they can't control it adequately and effectively and to good ends if they don't understand what the facts are.
We talked briefly in the green room about the imperial presidency, this concept that Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote a book about in 1973, starting with the Nixon presidency, when he said, when the president does it, that means it's legal. So a lot of commentators have said that the imperial presidency has been marching forward. It certainly got momentum with 9/11 when presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama started expanding the national security state. And I think with the way Trump swaggered as a candidate, there was thinking that he would come in as emperor, that he would further the imperial presidency. Do you think he is?
I don't think so, because I don't mean this to be inflammatory, but he really is learning what the job is and what it entails. Other people who have come in understood, and we've had a comment that many of the more important positions in the government, vast numbers of them, simply aren't filled, and it's because they haven't been nominated. Mr. Trump really is not moving to govern in the way that other presidents have.
Yes, sir.
My name is Sean Hanna. I'm a property investor, and I work in construction. So my comment about the power of the presidency, I feel like I'm one of the few people that I know that wasn't surprised that Trump was elected. I was, however, really surprised that so many people were so enraged and so afraid when he was elected. In my kid's school, the parents were upset that their kids would be deported and all of these things would be happening, and nothing was going to be the same. And the reason I wasn't afraid of those things is because I trust in the power of our Constitution and I know the limited powers of our president. It's a big conversation, but if you expect that the president is going to do a lot of things, and that the government is going to do a lot of things, someone mentioned that they need their government to do all of these things, then I can understand how you would also, wanting them to have so much power, would be afraid when someone that you disagree with gets into power. So for me, I think I would remind us that we can't really have both. You can't have a government that does all of these powerful things for you that can, on a whim, even in national emergency, work unchecked by the Supreme Court, or pass health care and solve all of these problems, and also have a limited power that they can't do a lot of bad things as well, or that the next president can't come in and do a lot of bad things. And so that's kind of my perspective.
Sean, thank you.
That was one engaged audience giving their views on power and the presidency at the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library and Museum. Up next, Brian McTavish and the Weekend To-Do List. Well, look who's here. Brian McTavish here to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend, and
ha-ha.
Welcome back.
Hey, hey,
there you
betcha.
Are, right across the table from me.
Just feet away. We're just feet apart.
Planet Comic-Con.
Yes.
It's your weekend. This is your time.
It's Kansas City.
You love this.
Fantasy Lovers Weekend.
This is where you shine. You haven't been this shiny in weeks since you've been in here.
The stars shine, and we bask in their light at Planet Comic-Con. It's the area's largest, biggest, bestest, you could even say, comic book and pop culture convention. It's 3 days.
My gosh.
It's downtown at Bartle Hall. It kicks off at noon to 7 on Friday, 10 to 7 on Saturday. And if you can't make it on Friday or Saturday, well, I'm disappointed. But you can go Sunday from 10 to 5.
Yeah.
And I'm into the funny books. I'm so into the funny books that I, you know, full disclosure, I have chosen this year to actually work a booth for a vendor because I can't get close enough to the four-color fun.
And a lot of folks can't. They even come away with autographs.
Oh,
this is a big deal at this thing.
Usually not for free.
Not for free.
I mean,
how much do they cost?
Well, you know, maybe $20 or $30 or $40 or $70.
People pay that kind of money for an autograph?
It's their dream. It's their dream. Now, I would like an autograph.
Of?
Well, you know, I'm free and easy. There's a lot of different creators there. Wonderful, gifted, talented, historic, legendary comics creators. One of more recent vintage, relatively speaking, is Amanda Connor, right? And Amanda Connor draws Power Girl better than anybody. And Harley Quinn, who's the Joker's silly sidekick. She draws Harley maybe really, really well.
You not only track comics, but you track who draws them and who these people are. And this is all part of the world here.
I'm looking for cheap old comics. Now, that theme that just went away out of my earphones there, that belongs to Harry Potter. I'm sure listeners recognized it. And we were playing that because
there's a reason.
Jason Isaacs, best known as the kind of, I guess, rotten Malfoy in the Harry Potter film series, he is going to be there. And you can get his autograph for some money, I guess. Also, real quickly, Ron Perlman, who played Hellboy in 2 or 3 or maybe 4 Hellboy movies, he was perfect in that role. Let's see, Will Wheaton, who's shows up on Big Bang Theory on TV and was part of the Star Trek Next Generation crew.
This is a world I know nothing about.
What about Kevin Eastman?
I know nothing about.
What about Kevin Eastman?
What about Kevin?
Well, he's one of the co-creators of the Teenage Ninja Mutant, or is it Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Yeah.
That was originally...
That's Kyle Palmer's, when he was 8 years old, that's his was his favorite song.
Oh, yeah.
His first concert.
Well, the Teenage?
Yeah, the Teenage Mutant
Ninja Turtles. Well, yeah, it began as a black and white comic book in the late 1980s before it exploded, and Kevin Eastman will be there, as well as wrestlers like Ric Flair.
But my point is, Kyle Palmer admits this.
Well,
when he was 8, this is who
here's the story.
His first concert.
We're older and guiltier about our pleasures. Kyle is a young, strong man.
Yes, he is.
And he is not ashamed of his pop culture indiscretions. Anyway, hey, if you have any interest in what's going on out there in the wild, woolly world of fantasy comics and fun, but you do, if you go, you'll be sucked into Planet Comic-Con.
Okay.
Go, go, go.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side?
Okay, let's talk Muppets. Let's talk puppets. Let's talk all those things.
I miss Jim Henson.
Yes, a lot of people do.
That is the voice, the original voice of Jim Henson doing
Jim Henson?
Kermit. That's him doing Kermit. That is the song that Kermit sings in the swamp over the opening titles to the first and best Muppet movie called The Muppet Movie from 1979. But here's something different to do with that fine classic of family fare. You can sing along and so much more with The Muppet Movie at 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon at Yardley Hall there at the Carlson Center at Johnson County Community College. Mm-hmm. It's a participatory family film experience. You can hurl confetti, you can blow bubbles, the puppets will emerge from or out of the screen. There'll be kiting and even shadow acting.
Wow.
And this is all brought to us from Heather Henson, daughter of the late, great Muppets creator, Jim Henson. Yeah, so this tours, and they have several different kinds of fun shows, but this is the sing-along with the Muppet movie, and I think it's well worth attending for all ages.
Be sure to see Brian's six interactive things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. That song still works, man. All these years later, it still works.
It's just got to be one of the picks.
It gets you going.
It's got to be one of the songs you'll hear at the U.S. Air Guitar Championships 2017 qualifier.
There's a national title awaiting someone for air guitar?
Yeah. And
that's the world we live in.
And an international title, okay? So you can behold the pretend guitar gods. And one of them's just got to play Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
9 o'clock, Friday night, The Bottleneck in Lawrence. Okay, very, very swiftly, let me tell you my favorite guitar solo, okay?
Which is?
It's from Let It Be, not the single release, the album version. The single release has this kind of namby-pamby dobro. The album version, you can play it at my funeral. Not happening anytime soon, I assure you. But that has the most kick-you-know-what guitar solo, Let It Be album version. I'm hearing it now.
You heard it, folks.
Flailing away.
All
yes.
All right.
Yes, yes.
I am your dog and I think you're neat. I like to chew on your antiques. I bark like crazy when you come in.
Doggies, doggies, doggies.
Yes, yes. No cats allowed at Chris Pondery's Stunt Dog Experience, a super family-friendly entertainment in which 12 or 20 or 30 of Chris's well-trained rescue dogs, right? They will jump, they will dance, they will form dog teams on stage for sections of the audience to root for.
And you can pay money and go see this.
Good money, good dog entertainment, 7 o'clock Friday night at the Leeds Center in Lawrence. We should all give that a kind thought.
That song still works too, by the way.
In so many ways.
Great song.
Hence its
great
inclusion song. Here. It's so malleable.
And
I love
Rod
that
Stewart
song.
Rod Stewart can't sing, but it works on that song.
Could he ever?
Yes.
Did he ever need to?
No.
That's right. Rod.
We got 20 seconds.
After you've seen
you
Rod
roll.
Throw a mic stand in the air, he doesn't need to sing. Okay, it's the People's Climate Rally in support of the People's Climate Movement March taking place in Washington, D.C. Speakers will include experts in sustainable design and agriculture and environmental justice. 1 to 3, Saturday, Washington Square Park.
And that's Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
I'll see you at Planet Comic-Con.
Yes, you will.
I'm dragging you in there.
Tomorrow, on Friday, the film critics are back here on KCUR's Up to Date. The Power in the Presidency event was brought to you with the help of Mike Russo, Matthew Long Middleton, Maria Carter, Cody Newell, Matt Hodapp, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro, all those folks helping out with one event. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.